Goodniks explores the journey and meaning of doing good in the world.
I get to choose every day when I wake up whether I'm going to work for a Fortune 500 and make a ton of money or work for the movement that is the arc of moral justice.
But I realized that I also had an obligation to weaponize my privilege.
One day we said, okay, if the city's not going to do it, the state's not going to do it, if some large corporation's not going to do it, why not us?
And if there were enough of you, if you were organized enough, if you were loud enough, it would be too difficult for them to ignore you.
Goodniks, created by Jeff Leitner, hosted by Annalisa Enrile, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Mealy, I have two problems.
What are those?
I really love the show on professional development, and I've a big blank spot on my chest where my shirt is.
First of all, the first one doesn't sound like a problem.
I mean, it's so much love, I can't contain it.
And you also have what, a blank spot on your chest?
Yeah, where my shirt is.
You never grew chest hair?
Obviously not.
Oh, I know what you should do. You should go to this link in the show notes and get an unprofessional development t-shirt.
Gasp! That sounds like exactly what I needed for this premise.
So boys and girls, we have t-shirts.
We have magnets. We have buttons.
Show your unprofessional love. That way you'll get to know who your fellow unprofessionals are when you're walking down the hallway and go, oh, you listen to that too?
Be an unprofessional representative. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a very cerebral episode of Unprofessional Development. I'm Tedesco.
And I'm Mealy. And today we have with us Art Markman. I heard him on a podcast called Rhetoric Warriors, which I definitely highly recommend. And of course, Art has his own podcast. Is Two Guys in Your Head. Is that right?
Two Guys on Your Head.
Yeah. On Your Head. Two Guys on Your Head. Get my prepositions right. So we like to have goofy prompts to try and get people like thinking rather than just listing like a chronological bio. So you're going to give us like background as if you're building a piece of IKEA furniture, but do keep the language. I know sometimes people, the language gets a little salty when they're building some IKEA furniture. So keep a PG for us. But yeah. Talk about that. What are some of the pieces that you put together and what does it look like when we're done?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because my feeling about anybody's career is it's actually nothing like IKEA furniture, although perhaps sort of like IKEA furniture in the sense that you have no idea what it is you're getting into from the beginning. Yeah. And then when it's done, you can look back on it and try and tell some kind of story about how things work. But I tell people all the time, don't try to edit your life story in the forward direction. You know, just let things happen and then take it where it goes. But
yeah. There's plenty of times that I was supposed to build a table from IKEA and it turned into a bookshelf because I put things in the wrong place. Well, that happens.
Whatever life hands you, you just take a screw and connect it.
Yes,
exactly. And then hopefully you don't lean on it the wrong way and the whole thing comes tumbling down.
Yeah. When life gives you flurgans, make lemonade.
So I was a cognitive science major as an undergrad because I couldn't really figure out what to major in. My sophomore year, I went to an advisor and I said, well, I'm not sure what to major in, but I took a psych class and I kind of liked it, but I don't want to be a psychologist. And I took some computer science and I liked that, but I don't really want to be a computer scientist. And I took a linguistics class and that was cool, but I don't want to be a linguist. And I took a philosophy class and that was fun, but I don't want to be a philosopher. And so I went through this whole list and she looked at me and she said, you know, everything you just described counts towards the major in cognitive science. Is it possible you're a cognitive scientist? And I said, sure, why not? So I did that and I was a college student in the mid 80s. Computers were slow and stupid back then. And so as interested as I was in artificial intelligence, I think machines weren't up to the task. I ended up deciding to go to graduate school in psychology, studied cognition, studied analogy and reasoning and comparison and, you know, then categorization and other things, you know, lucked into a job, ultimately my first tenure track job at Columbia University, spent 5 years there, and then picked up a job at the University of Texas, where I've been for the last 24 years. Spent the first 15 years of my research career being a pretty typical academic, writing papers that get read by 30 of my closest colleagues, teaching the occasional class. And generally finding things that seem like fun to do. about 20. Well, two interesting things happened. One was,
so as this I got is when you like dump out the box and you goes, hey, what was this piece doing right, in here?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
I thought I had all the pieces laid out and there's one stuck behind this styrofoam.
Right. What I was I supposed to use that? So I got to the middle of my career and I thought, gosh, almost everybody I know has a mind. Almost nobody knows how that mind works because almost nobody gets to learn any psychology. Is there a way of trying to bring this to more people? And so I did all kinds. I started blogging for Psychology Today. I actually joined the advisory board of the Dr. Phil show in the hope that I could bring a little science into people's days.
And we're going down that rabbit trail at some point, but go ahead.
I've been on the show a few times, in fact.
Nice. Wow.
As I like to say, some people won't listen to what you have to say unless they're paying for the information. So I started doing some consulting for companies and bringing cognitive science to them. And that led me to start developing some one day classes for those companies. And that led to a couple of the books that I've written, Smart Thinking and Smart Change, both emerged out of classes I developed for companies. And then that, when universities like their faculty to go out and do this kind of thing, because it brings our knowledge to the business world.
Yeah.
So you have to declare it. So that because we basically as faculty have one day a week of up to one day a week that you can spend on that kind of work. And so the dean knew what I was up to. And in 2013, 2011, actually, they reached out to me and they said, we're thinking that in the College of Liberal Arts that we ought to create some kind of outward facing master's program, bringing the liberal arts to the business world. But we're not sure how to do it. We think you might know how to do it. Would you help? So, not wanting to edit my life in the forward direction, I said, sure. And I ended up helping to create a program here called the Human Dimensions of Organizations. That started out as an executive master's program. So the humanities, social, and behavioral sciences applied to business, government, nonprofits, and the military. Added some non-credit classes to that people could just come in and take for a day. And then backfilled that whole thing with an undergraduate major. So we actually have 500 undergrads wandering around the university saying that they're HDO majors. So they think it's a thing. The most surreal experience you can have is watching a bunch of students walk across the stage, getting a degree in a thing you named.
Yeah.
Like that's a very strange.
Yeah. It was weird for me the first time it happened.
Most people I talk to have had that experience and they agree with me.
Yes.
Then let's see. And then the two other things have happened over the last several years that have been kind of fun might not be quite the right word. One of them is that in April of 2020, I learned another valuable lesson, which is that when the provost of your university texts you at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon and says, can I give you a call? He's not about to make your life easier. And so he wasn't
taking you out to the ball game.
Well, he said, geez, you seem to know something about the way organizations work, and we need somebody to help us run the COVID planning process for the university.
Oh, God.
So how about it? And that's
and you said no.
Well, it's kind of a rhetorical question. I actually got off the phone. I looked at my wife. I said, I really can't say no to this, can I? And she said, no, you can't. So I sort of dropped everything I was doing to try to figure out how to open a small city during a pandemic. And that was fascinating.
How'd it go? Actually.
All things considered, it went pretty well.
Okay.
We didn't have to close down. We didn't annoy too many people on either side of the issue, but we annoyed everyone to some degree, which is pretty much what we expected.
That's just a compromise. Yeah.
Right. Right. No, exactly. What we said at the beginning was we're going to get everybody angry in some way. Yeah. So let's at least hope that they trust enough in the process that they'll accept what we do. And that seems to be the way it played out. So it worked out okay. As I was having lots of discussions with folks in the upper administration, they wanted to create a way of coordinating our activities for what we affectionately can call non-traditional learners. So not your typical undergraduates and typical graduate students, PhD students and MBA students and things like that. And so I have ended up in a role as a vice provost at the university where I coordinate both continuing in professional education and actually any kind of new venture that somebody has a thought about, even if it does intend to reach our undergraduates or our grad students. So it's been fun. I've been doing that about a year and a half, and I bought a Death Star clock to as evidence that I'd gone over to the dark side of, nice. Of education.
Yeah,
it's been a blast.
That's fine. Cool. Grand Moff Tarkin had a pretty good run. Like, you'll be fine.
Oh, absolutely. I Darth Art doesn't work that well, but it's just hard to say.
Yeah, Darth Markman sounds good. Darth I like Markman Darth Markman
works, though. Yeah,
yeah, that works.
I may have to go with that.
Yeah.
So I heard this. I just want to break it down. So you said you're working to help like non-typical learners. Would that be people with like who are neurodiverse, or would that be people with like whose backgrounds or whose mindsets are just not helping them get through like the collegiate process?
Yeah, I think when I really what I mean is sort of non-traditional students, meaning universities have a type, you know. So when you think college student, you think 18 to 22 year old, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, shaggy haired graduate student who with backpack who's, mm-hmm. who's pursuing a PhD in an obscure subject, or an MBA student, right? I mean, those are that.
Right.
But what we don't necessarily think of is a 40 year old who needs to learn a bunch of new skills in order to keep up with technological advances,
right?
Or, you know,
his career. His career got outsourced and he needs to come in.
Or a member of the military who's trying to transition to civilian life, or, mm-hmm. We need to be learning stuff across the lifespan and now more than ever, because of just how quickly the job market changes and universities need to be providing that education, but have not historically always been well designed to do it. And so a lot of what we're trying to do is to take all of this expertise that we have at the university and figure out how do we bring it to other people, particularly because universities are also set up around the credit hour, you know, mm-hmm. where I'm going to take a 3-credit class. I'm going to spend 45 hours over the course of a semester in the classroom and do some assignments. Credits are nice. They're a great way of organizing an undergraduate degree. Mm-hmm. But most people who are trying to transform their career in one way or another, that credit hour is not really the right unit. So, you know, I mean, maybe we want them to come in for 4 days and learn something. And so we need to be much more flexible in the way that we craft the kind of education that we mm-hmm. provide and deliver that education. And it has to be really immediately meaningful. You know, a 19-year-old in a class. First of all, 19-year-olds don't know anything yet, so they just you tell them stuff and they go, oh, cool.
I think I was 24 before I knew something.
I think that's typically right.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, that's about the right age where you've had enough experience where you finally say, wait a second, that thing somebody just told me that's BS, right? That's just ridiculous. And what's nice about teaching a 40-year-old is they come in and they've got this lifetime of experience. And so they immediately sniff out stuff that's wrong.
Yeah.
And what they want to know is, okay, that's great. I'm glad you told me that. What do I do with this?
Yeah.
And what's really beautiful about this from the standpoint of university faculty is we get hired because we're good at research, and then they throw us into the classroom because that's the business model.
Right.
And so what happens is, as a faculty member, you do a research project, and your research project, I'm going to torture a metaphor for you here. That research project is can be symbolized by the head of a pin, mm-hmm. you know, and occasionally you have to describe sort of the point of the pin when you in order to talk about the head of the pin in your research, but you never describe the whole pin, let alone the pin cushion or the table on which that pin cushion rests.
Yeah.
When you start talking to people who are going to use what you know at work the next day, if you're successful, mm-hmm. you actually have to place all of your knowledge in a much broader context.
Yeah.
And really think about how do all the pieces fit together so that I can tell a coherent story that is going to allow somebody to have enough understanding of what you're trying to teach them, that they can apply it in complex situations that they're going to face at work. And that exercise is transformative for the teachers.
Yeah.
In addition to being transformative for the learners. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, my brain's going 19 different places right now, but I'm going to kind of try and.
I think we should have asked him what he hasn't done. I think that would have been.
Well, I also play the sax in a ska band.
Cool. Oh, that's.
We're called Darth Markman. That's the name of the band.
Phineas Gage, actually.
Oh, cool.
Wait, is that a real thing?
That's our band is Phineas Gage.
Cool.
Wow.
So first of all, shout out to my alma mater. So I was a non-traditional student. So I flunked out of college the first time. And then I went back to school and I went to this school called Western Governors University.
Oh, yeah. They've done really tremendous work.
The cheapest, best online university I've ever heard of. And they call it competency-based education. And that's what they did. Like, okay, you know, and it's based on, okay, here's what you need to know to, they do still have the credits, but like to get these three credits, you need to know this. In order to do that, you need to write two essays on these topics and take a test on this topic, whatever. And if it's going to take you like 5 months to do that, cool. If it's going to take you 5 days, when I went, I was unemployed and I just take a class basically for like 20 hours in a row over the course of like 3 or 4 days and knock it out. Or sometimes I was familiar with the content and I'm like, oh, I can write an essay on that. Just tell me what, show me the rubric. Boom, I got it. Yeah. And so it was really neat. And I think that's a different way to do it. And like what you're saying, sometimes people need to see the whole pin cushion. And sometimes after they see the pin cushion, they'll go, well, what does that pin over there do so that I can look at that? But we have to kind of address where they are and what's going on.
Oh,
and
yeah.
If we can do that as educators, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So I want to like go down the Dr. Phil rabbit trail just for a minute. And so what was that like? What did you learn? What did you learn from that experience that's helped you as you know, when you're doing the rest of the things that you do?
Well, you know, one thing I got was just a vision into, you know, what goes into producing a juggernaut kind of TV show. And you know, obviously Dr. Phil has all, you know, I mean, his main MO is making people cry on national television.
Right.
And, you know, my goal was, you know, I wasn't going to change the way he did what he did, but we could slip a little science into people's day. Mm-hmm. That would be cool. And the most interesting thing was he brought all these members of his advisory board out to LA early on. You know, the show had been on for a few years, and at the very end of our visit, he said to us, he said to all of us, well, if any of you ever have anything you're trying to sell, then you let me know.
Oh.
And my thought at the time was, what are you talking about? Right. I mean, like, what in the world am I going to have to sell? And then I wrote my first book for a popular audience.
Yeah.
And I thought, wait a second.
Dr. Phil should write the
foreword. I have a thing to sell. And I wrote to him and I said, is this what you meant? And like 20 minutes later, he wrote back, yep. And the next thing I knew, I'd been scheduled to come out on the show.
Nice.
And he was great. He looked at the camera and he said, buy this book. And
nice.
and then people bought that book. And
nice.
Yeah, it was great. And so I've written 4 books over the last 10 years or so, and he's had me on the show for each of them. And
wow.
It has caused a pleasant bump in sales.
Yeah, I bet it does. I bet it does. Wow. By the way, this is time number 3. I'm keeping track of these. Let's go. We are 2 degrees away from Oprah, who we would love to have on our podcast like 3 times now. Okay.
Yeah.
So Principal L had met Oprah. You've met Dr. Phil. Have you ever met Oprah?
I've not met Oprah, but I've met Mehmet Oz.
Okay. Okay.
So I've got 2 degrees of separation to Oprah 2 ways over.
2 ways. Okay.
Yeah.
And then we had Tony Danza on our podcast. I don't know if you know that or not. And he's been on Oprah's podcast. So
cool. There you go.
So she's got to have heard of us by now.
Yeah. I'm thinking.
So long an asteroid can circle around in orbit before it becomes a meteorite and connection happens.
Or it gets arrested for stalking.
Yes.
One of those two things. Yeah.
Exactly. Something like that. Yes.
She seems to be stalking us. That's what I'm saying.
I know. That's what I'm saying. It's pretty much
honestly, officer, she's stalking me. That's a defense that almost off. Always works.
I just need some space. All right. Calm down, Oprah. All right. So I want to talk to you about cognitive science. It really blows my mind that the structure that we have for education, like education has been a career for a thousand years, and like modern day education, maybe
more
like
than that. I think Socrates is a little older than 1,000 years.
But like our modern concept of education, maybe like 300 years, like the modern classroom sort of setup.
Yeah.
And we've only really been exploring psychology for like 100 years. And those two really don't overlap very often. And it's ridiculous. Like teachers just don't know how the brain works and how learning. A lot of people still struggle understanding how learning works, like on a psychological level. So let's talk about cognitive science exactly. So what are misconceptions? What are common practices? What can teachers be re-examining if they knew more about cognitive science?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it's just, I think anything you end up learning about the way that minds work ends up being really beneficial. So I'll just throw out a few things that are really low-hanging fruit. So one of them is that education, generally speaking, is an individual sport and life is a team sport. And so we actually need to include much more team engagement towards solving hard problems to get people really used to working together to do things. And absolutely, at some point, we need to also make sure that individuals know stuff so that we don't have people who slip through the cracks, you know, going through their whole education, getting somebody
else. Can you put my name on the project? Just put my name on it. Okay. I need the credit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Honestly, I'll bring you some Jolly Ranchers tomorrow. Exactly. So I think, you know, teamwork. I think another thing is we need to teach people to explain how stuff works. I think we don't hold people accountable for the details of understanding how the world around them works. One of my favorite concepts in all of cognitive science comes from a colleague of mine named Frank Kyle at Yale, who it's called the illusion of explanatory depth. And it's this observation that we all believe we understand the world better than we actually understand the world, which is something that teachers discover when they try to teach something for the first time. Because they're like, oh, yeah, I could go in and teach that. And then they're like 3 minutes in, they're like, okay, not quite sure how this piece works or this piece works. When I send grad students who've graduated off to teach at a university for the first time, my last little bit of parting wisdom is always, it's going to take you 7 hours to prepare each hour of an undergraduate lecture because you're going to discover all the stuff you don't really understand and couldn't explain if you wanted to. And so, you know, you end up having to really dig in to understand the fine details so that you can describe it to somebody. But the thing is, we need to get students doing that kind of explanation on a routine basis and holding each other accountable for understanding the details of stuff. Because I think we have created this environment in which people give us explanations for the way the world works that we don't understand. Like somebody will say something, they'll use a lot of buzzwords and other things, and you'll just sit there and go, oh, wow, this person is way smarter than I am, and that's why I don't understand this. And what we have to do is to say, no, if you really understood this, you would be able to explain it to me in language I understand. Yeah. And if you can't do it, it's your fault, not mine. And I think I think part of the way that we hold people accountable for that is if we become adept at explaining things to other people, then we can actually say, look, I know how to explain stuff I understand to other people. You ought to know that too. And what that does is to give us much better knowledge, because you cannot solve a new problem unless you understand the way things work. If you don't understand the way things work, all you can do is execute a procedure.
The analogy that comes to my mind is like teaching someone how to drive, and you go, well, you spin this thing here, and you put your foot on one of these two pedals here. And then, of course, if someone would ask you, well, when I push my foot on that pedal, like what's actually
happening. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the amount of people that actually understand
the elves working in the engine make it move.
Run faster. Yeah. that's right. And the thing is, so I can drive my car without understanding the way it works, but as soon as something breaks, I am stuck.
Right.
Right. And the thing is, when you ask, what is a smart person? Like, people look at me, they say, well, a college professor, he must be a pretty smart guy. I don't understand how my car works. If my car breaks down, I bring it to the mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
Who's the smart person in this picture? Okay. Big hint, not the PhD college professor,
right?
Because I don't understand how it works. And the mechanic who has knowledge, understanding, and tools and skills, that's the smart person in that picture. Mm-hmm. So the smart piece is, if the more you understand about the way things in the world work, the more that you can take some situation that's gone awry, mm-hmm, and fix it.
Right.
And when it comes to complex social problems, you know, which is the other piece where I think psychology is a big benefit, teaching people the way that we function as humans,
yes,
gives us a vocabulary for helping everyone to understand where they go wrong, you know. And I think another place where cognitive science is beneficial is actually teaching the content of it. You know, we systematized the modern science curriculum about 100 years ago, which, you know, as you're pointing out, is just about the time that we started studying psychology. And consequently, the three sciences that made the cut, K-12, are biology, chemistry, and physics,
right,
which were much more mature in the early 20th century. You know, in 1910, you could teach everything there was to know about psychology in about an hour. And now
it's your mother.
Okay. It's ghosts in your brain. Do cocaine about it.
Yes, exactly. Now we know more. And so it's actually valuable to learn that so that you can deal with other people effectively, so that you have a vocabulary for talking about the way you think and the way that you interact. So I think knowing some psychology matters a lot. And then the last thing I think that that's really critical is just to really understand that nobody learns anything just by hearing somebody say it.
Oh, what?
I know.
We've been lecturing for 100 years now.
I know.
Write this down.
Says on the podcast. There'll be
a test on Friday.
Yeah. Right. Well, but you know, it's so fascinating. We believe so deeply in the value of lecture that in college lecture halls, we nail the chairs to the floor.
Yes.
You know, we got to get people doing stuff and not just writing papers about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, doing things, making things, you know, actually doing a project that has to work. I think one of the fundamental problems with education is how rarely we actually have to build something that works. One of the reasons,
yeah,
I loved studying computer science, you know, as part of my cognitive science background in college, was because it wasn't enough in a computer science class to say, oh yeah, I get how that works. Like, if they want you to take an arbitrarily ordered list of numbers and sort them from smallest to largest, it's not enough to say, yeah, I get it. You've actually got to write the program, mm-hmm, and the program has to take some arbitrarily ordered list of numbers and sort them from smallest to largest. And until it does that, you're not done.
There you go.
And I think that a lot of what qualifies as learning,
mm-hmm,
K-12, you know, college, doesn't require the thing you do to work. And so you don't appreciate the really fine details that are associated with completing something.
Yeah.
You know, we write like 2/3 of an essay, you know, because we're busy, even in English. You know, I mean, an essay is a thing, but an essay isn't a polished thing,
yeah,
right? So getting somebody to the point where they've written it and then rewritten it and then rewritten it again and then totally reorganized it because it turns out that the way that you'd set it up the first time wasn't right, you know,
yeah,
that's hard work. And, you know, having now written books, the process you go through to go from this garbled set of ideas you have to actually a whole book is completely different. than most of the writing instruction that I got.
Just an introduction and then three paragraphs and then a conclusion that's basically a regurgitation of the introduction,
right?
Which had the three points in the three paragraphs. That's not how things work.
Right. None of which followed one from the next.
Yeah.
You know, and so I thought of three things. I strung them together in my essay. Then I wrote an introduction that told people that was what I was going to tell them, and a conclusion that told them what I was going to tell them, so we actually have to build stuff that works and, you know, build completed projects, be accountable for the details of things. I mean, those are the things that, I mean, you know, and it's hard. And that's the other thing. The other thing that cognitive science teaches is, you know, learning is hard, and it's frustrating, and there are times where you don't know the answer to something, and you have to search for it. So that's the other thing that bothers me is you go through most of your education, through most of college, answering questions that the person who asked the question already knows the answer to.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Which is weird.
And right. It's multiple choice, so there's only one of four possible answers.
Right. Right.
Yes.
And you know, and you know, I mean, can you imagine somebody walks up to you on the street, says, "What time is it?" And they say, "Well, it's 2:30," and they go, "Exactly right." Like, you know, that's not the way
your boss says, "I need the sales numbers from the branch in such and such," and you bring them back, and he's like, "Oh yeah, I already had that."
Yeah, thanks. Yep.
The IRS actually says that to me every April, but
that's true. That's very true. But generally speaking, right, that's not what we're being paid to do. So we have to give people more experience with answering questions that nobody's sure the answer to yet, and more experience with that really uncomfortable feeling that I'm not sure how to make progress on this yet. I have to live with that uncertainty for a while. I mean, I tell a story. So when we created the Human Dimensions of Organizations undergraduate program, because I was director of the program at that time, I cleverly said, "I'll teach the intro class." Now this is an intro class that was going to have to be taught about 2 years from the moment that I said that. Mm-hmm. And then somebody said, "Great, you're on." And then a week later, I was like, "Wait a second. No one's ever taught this class before because this discipline doesn't really exist. So there's no textbook. There's nobody else's syllabus I can borrow. How am I going to teach this?" And I realized I had no idea. and I would think about it regularly, like, you know, an hour or so a week, every week. And for a full year, I still had no idea how I was going to structure the class. I mean, none whatsoever. People would say, "Oh, you're teaching the intro class. Yeah. How's it going?" "Well, I don't know." But I was sort of fine with that because I also knew I was thinking about it. I was having conversations about it. I was reading things. I figured something's going to come to me.
Yeah.
and then about a year into it, I was like, "Oh, I could organize the class around some themes, like how to negotiate. And then bring different disciplines that have thought about negotiation, psychology, history, sociology, and just bring, you know, and bring examples of negotiation and then do that for some other theme." And then once I had that idea, then I just had to decide what were the themes going to be and then talk to colleagues to say, "Okay, what is your discipline? Give me an example of a place where your discipline talked about somebody resolving a dispute." And then I would compile that together, find some stuff that I felt was going to be right for undergraduates to read, and then put that together and then develop the assignments that would go along with helping people to understand that a core aspect of any education is to understand the content that a discipline teaches, the methodology that it uses to get to that content. And then to think about how you might take that methodology and content and apply it to solving some other problem. And that if you learn that little cycle of learning some content, learning that methodology, and then using that in context, that you've succeeded. And what was fascinating to me was, in retrospect, how crazy it is to be comfortable for a full year of, I've got to teach this thing. I'm going to have to step in front of a room full of 100 students and teach a thing. And I have no earthly idea what it's going to be like. But you
that's
know,
that's like scary, but it's also sounds to me, it sounds fun. Like
I loved it.
You're gonna learn as much as they're gonna learn while right. you're doing
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, I loved it.
Were you honest to them in the beginning? Did you say, "Hey, I've got a plan, but we're also winging it."
Yep. And I also told them, you're gonna ask me questions in class, and I'm not gonna know the answer, and I'm gonna go find the answer and then bring it back. And sometimes I'm gonna ask you to also find it, and we'll compare notes. Yeah. You know, yeah, it was great. It was so much fun. But you have to. You have to learn to live with that kind of uncertainty. And I definitely told the students, hey, we're winging this because, you know, we're just figuring this out, because I wanted them to be partners in that. And I wanted them to see that when you build a thing, you actually build the plane while as you're flying it.
Yeah.
And that's okay, because that's actually the way most of life works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did this thing. I've done it twice now. And it was just like a basic thing. Cause I wanted to get, I teach seniors in high school math. Right. Mm-hmm. And due to COVID and everything else, they're coming in. And I know that the majority of them have at best eighth grade math skills. Like they've seen some stuff and they've done some stuff, but they haven't retained very much. And even pre-COVID, they would only retain so much. So I said, okay, what can we do to kind of let's just scratch the rust off and just do some simple mathy stuff, but you know, so I showed them like a wall to begin with. I said, how would you figure out how many bricks are in this wall? Oh, I just take this and multiply it and do that. Okay, then I showed them like a small building that had some doors and some windows, and what would we do? And first the kid's like, length times width times height. I'm like, well, that would give us a building that was completely full of bricks and this one's empty on the inside, so no. And then I said, okay, well, the building that we're in, how many bricks would it take? That's what we want to build another building just like this. Our job is the contractor that's in charge of the brick part, and he's got to order enough bricks, enough to build the building. So let's just go out. You can take as many pictures as you want. You can be in like groups of two or three, and we're going to figure out how many bricks are in this building. And so we go out, and like all of a sudden they realize the complexity of the stuff that's going on. And they're like, well, those windows are different sizes, and this floor has this many of this. And what about where the building kind of like goes in and there's a little overhang? And finally they're like, so Mr. Mealy, like, how many bricks does the building have? And I'm like, I don't know.
Right.
Like, what do you mean?
That's
you
your cool said, job, not mine.
I just came up with the problem.
I gave you the problem.
Listen, let's find out, you know? And they're like, what are you talking about? You don't know. I don't know. But it was a lot of fun. You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
My senior year of high school.
That's so cool.
I had a physics class, and the first lab that we did was called the Wonder Lab. And it was just a bunch of questions like that. So it was like, I wonder how many blades of grass are on the football field. And there was like a stream out back, and I wonder how fast the water moves. And I wonder if you drew a straight line from the front of the classroom to the library upstairs, like that door, how long would that line be? And he just, the whole week is like, here's the whole lab, go.
And that was it. Those kinds of experiences, I think, are so important. And that experience that the students had, you know, with the bricks of, wait, you don't know the answer to this? No, we're just trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, and by the way, that's a thing people have to do.
Right. The guy that built this building, he didn't know how many bricks it took to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And he didn't want to end up a few bricks short of a building.
Right. If he had too many, if there was like twice as many bricks like sitting around on pallets when we were done, he was going to be in trouble.
He was going to get fired, right? Or have to build another building. One of the two. Yeah.
Right. Figure out where to bury the bricks. Yeah.
That's right. That's next to Jimmy Hoffa, apparently.
Exactly. Oh man.
That's great. So I really do think that the more people know about the way minds work, you know, the better their life gets.
Yeah. One thing I've done, especially with my high school students, in the middle school, not so much, but some, is I try to connect anything to what we're reading in class, you know, in the literature reading. And then I just go over things like, cognitive dissonance and logical fallacies. And we talk about the Dunbar number and you know, just introduce some of these things to say, like, so these things at play. And by the way, that's also how your brain doesn't work. And these are all the problems you're going to have in life because of it. So sorry that your laptop came with Internet Explorer, but that's kind of how our brains are.
Yeah. But the earlier you learn that, the better you adapt to it. Mm-hmm. You know, because you use tools to address the limitations of the mind. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, because that's the other thing is we're, you know, there's a lot of stuff we're bad at. The reason you want to keep a really good calendar is because you can't remember that stuff.
Right.
Right. Right. So don't. Exactly. Right. That's why we use tools. Use the tools to do the stuff you can't do. Mm-hmm. Do the things you're good at.
Yep.
And then find other people who are good at stuff you're not good at and build a team that has, you know, like I, you know, I, one of the things I say a lot, there's the five core personality characteristics. And one of them is conscientiousness, which is, you know, to what degree do you complete the stuff you start? And there's a kind of moderately negative relationship between conscientiousness and creativity that, because you have to sort of be a rule breaker to really be creative. So universities go out of their way to hire people who are sort of moderate to low in conscientiousness because we're somewhat creative. And then we're self-governing institutions.
Yeah.
and that's somewhat problematic. So, so what I've discovered having to put in various leadership roles is I've had to kind of come to grips with the fact that I'm, you know, moderate in conscientiousness. So I need to surround myself with really conscientious people.
There you go.
Who make sure that the stuff I said I was going to do gets done.
Yep.
And that's the beauty of having a good team.
Mm-hmm.
I get it.
I'm that way for Tedisco. And then I've had other people who are that way for me. And I've kind of become a little, I've learned how to be a little more conscientious. I don't know how that happened. The answer is in the building. One of the reasons we formed this podcast is because I learned when I talk to other teachers, hey, you're better at like making lesson plans, or you're better at creating assessments. So like, how can we as a team get together? And that's like what we need to be doing as educators all the time, is just have that conversation with the person in the hallway, you know, take them out to dinner, whatever it is, and then go, okay, da 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 da. And sometimes it happens very specifically where you know there's something you want out of them. And sometimes it just happens where we're just in an organic conversation and we're just talking about our day. And then all of a sudden you go, oh my goodness, really? That's what you do? You know?
I need help with that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happenstance, serendipity. It's so great. Yeah, no, that's that's why I love having random conversations with people, is because you then discover, oh, wait a second. I think we could do something together.
Yeah, that's awesome.
As you work with these diverse populations and people that, you know, not your typical academics at college, do you notice that there's any big differences in terms of like the teaching of the younger students, or like giving like professional development to like adults?
You know, I think that there are differences in both directions. So one of the things I mentioned earlier is, you know, is that adults know stuff and younger people don't know a ton. So it's a little bit harder for them to evaluate the quality of what they're learning. So I think, you know, that's one interesting part about working with older adults. But I think that one of the things about working with younger students, particularly pre-college, is that they're often much more curious about things. You know, I think one of the things that we do the longer somebody goes on in education is that we stamp out a lot of curiosity. Yeah. At some point, people just assume, you know what, someone out there must know what it is I need to know. And so if you'll just teach me the things I need to know, and I can dispense with all the rest of the questions. And I, you know, it bothers me because I've written about and studied creativity a little bit. And, you know, one of the things that you see whenever somebody, I mean, a lot of creativity basically involves taking knowledge that you had from one domain of your expertise and finding a way to apply it to some other area that nobody had done that before. And then having an insight that nobody had. And what that means is that you don't know which piece of information was going to turn out to be really crucial until after you needed it. And if you didn't have the information, you'll never know you needed it because you won't be the one who had the insight. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the older people get, the more that they're likely to use my least favorite question as a professor, which is this going to be on the exam?
There you go.
Right? Because that makes this presumption that I know what you need to know. And so I can tell you, yeah, this is the stuff you really need to focus on. So after years of grappling with that question, I suddenly realized the answer to that question. So now any student comes to me and says, Professor Markman, is this going to be on the exam? I say, yes, but it might not be my exam.
Nice.
Perfect.
That is good.
I know what you're saying. That's why I don't want to teach adults though. Like they already think they know the answer. So getting adults to change their minds, I think, is a lot harder than getting a kid to change their mind.
Well, yes, but I think there are times where adults come, particularly when they come to kind of continuing education situations, it's because they've realized there's something they can't do. Mm-hmm. You know, so for example, with the people that I teach a lot, you know, they are technically very savvy, but now they're in a people management role and people are an utter mystery to them. and so they've realized nobody's doing what I want them to do. And the meetings I run are a mess. And, you know, so they come in with a very specific problem to solve. And the difficulty I have is in trying to convince them that the particular question they want the answer to is often the wrong question.
There you go.
So I spend a lot of my life talking to people and trying to figure out what question should they really have asked, mm-hmm. given the difficulties that they're having, and then try to give them an understanding of some set of principles that will help them to navigate the situation that created the question they have.
Yep.
But to do it by helping them to understand that the real reason they're having that problem isn't why they think they're having that problem, but because actually they don't understand something about human motivation, or they don't understand something about, the way that people solve problems.
Have you ever seen that map? It was like a World War, I think one or two. And it's a picture of a plane with markings on it where all the bullet holes are. You know what I'm talking about? You know that one, Disco? And like where do we need to put armor? And these are all the planes that have come back from battle, right. You know? And so we're thinking, where do we need to put armor? And the question is no. The question is actually, what about the planes that didn't make it from battle?
Right. So don't reinforce the places where the holes are.
Right.
Reinforce the places where the holes aren't.
Aren't. Right.
Because those were the places that brought the plane down. Exactly.
I read about that in a book called "You Are Not So Smart." His piece on, I think the fallacy is called survivor bias or survivorship bias.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Right, the people are like, "Oh, this guy never went to college and he became the super megastar."
Well, yeah, that's
think about all the people who didn't go to college who failed at being a super megastar. Right. We don't have that number.
Right. Who you've never heard of.
Right.
Exactly. Let's play the percentages, folks.
Yes. Right. But our brains don't do that on their own.
No. Yes.
There's also a self-serving bias there, which is if you hate school, you find the one person who survived without school and you think, I could be that person.
Yeah.
Right. In the same way that, you know, when you're six, you think, or eight, you think, I could be a professional basketball player.
Of course you could. Right.
Definitely.
Yes. The main thing you need to do is be like Michael Jordan and get cut your sophomore year. And then that's how you end up being the greatest player ever.
Apparently.
Or get magical shoes. That's what Like Mike taught me.
There you go. I got cut from almost every team I ever. So at some point I'm going to be a superstar.
I never tried out for a team, so I'm doing better than Jordan. I'm amazing. I haven't been rejected once.
Never been cut. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Well, that's the other. Well, I love that statistic too. It's like, well, I'm 53 years old now, and so every day, what's 53 times 365? Every single one of those days, I've not died, and that is a lot of days in a row that I've not died. So obviously, statistically, I'm never going to die.
Yeah. I had a colleague whose email
days of evidence of that. You know.
Right. Yeah, I had a colleague whose email signature said "immortal till proven otherwise."
Okay. Now I didn't even play it. Well, I'm guessing Tedisco did. How much Zelda did you play, Tedisco?
endless amounts.
Okay. And that's what we need kids to realize is, I don't know if you're going to need this key or this rope or this whatever it is, but just stick it in your backpack. Right. Okay. Like
what's the worst? Right. And unlike most backpacks, your brain doesn't fill up.
Right.
So just learn it.
Right.
And then, yeah. And then someday you'll be the person who knew it.
Right.
And you'll be the one who has the great idea. And yeah, it's so important. Because that's all there is, right? At some point when you're trying to solve a hard problem, all yeah. you've got is the stuff that's in your head right now and mm-hmm. the problem. Yeah. And so all you can do at that moment is then try to get stuff out of your head, which yeah. means keep describing the problem in different ways mm-hmm. until something you know pops out of your head and helps you to solve the problem, because the only other alternative is you don't know anything and that's going to help you, and then you're stuck.
Or blame somebody else and just pass the buck.
Also a time-honored tradition. Yeah,
it was like that when I got here. That's right. That's what I say about the coffee machine being jammed every time.
Yeah. Wasn't me.
Right.
Nope.
Yeah.
It was like that.
Until they install the camera.
The amount of times that they'll send me an email saying, hey, you're not allowed to do this anymore. And I just think, I'm choosing not to understand this.
Right. I misread that email.
I don't need to find a solution if I don't acknowledge a problem.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. So I think we've covered a lot of the stuff that we want to cover. And thank you again, first of all, for being here. And we like funny stories and anecdotes from the world of education. So we always try to end on some kind of like little funny story or anecdote. So something a student did, a colleague did, or whatever, that you go, I couldn't believe when I was trying to teach this, this happened in the classroom or whatever. So hit me with a good one that you share around the water cooler or the cocktail party, whatever.
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, college teaching is fascinating largely because it devolves eventually into doing 3 hours of stand-up comedy.
Nice.
and the hardest thing about some kind of teaching is I've had a couple of semesters where I've taught the same class back to back.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the worst thing, because you just find yourself go halfway through the second lecture about to tell the great joke you have for this part of the class, uh-huh. and then suddenly freezing and thinking, wait, did I already tell this joke to this class today?
Uh-huh.
And I will say, it finally did happen. Usually I would just plow through and go, no, I couldn't possibly have told the joke. And nice. I finally did the thing where I got halfway through the joke and they just looked at me and I went, oh, I already told that today. And they were like, yes.
Oh, that is so good.
That was horrible.
Oh my goodness. So, take the needle, move it to the next track.
Okay. That's right. That's right. It was horrible. It was just
this
the worst.
I
was
skipping here.
And it took all the wind out of my sails for the rest of the lecture. It was just defeated Art Markman standing in front of the class going, you all get A's.
I swear I'm funny.
Just don't tell anyone.
Oh, that is fantastic. I have not done that. I'm sure it will happen sometime, but it has not happened.
I've not done it in one class, but like I'll make a joke and then like a few days later make the same joke, because I don't remember which classes I say the joke.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That, and I will say the most perceptive, you know, at the college level, a lot of your teaching evaluation comes from student course mm-hmm. evaluations, and they both rate the class and then give biting comments, you know, in the nice. Comment section. So I think my most perceptive student, my second year teaching, which now goes back several years, wrote, "Professor thinks he's God."
Wow.
I was like, wow, I didn't think it would come through that that clearly that early on.
And nice. That's when you change your email signature to divine until proven otherwise.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And you smited him is what you did.
I smote.
Yes. Smitten is when you think someone's cute. And
yeah, right. That's
when they smite you, you're smitten.
That yes. Yeah. No, I no, not good.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you having on. So guys, whether he's on Dr. Phil, whether you get one of his books, we'll put all this stuff, you know, in the show notes here, listen to his podcast and two guys on your brain. Okay?
On your head.
On your head. See, I can mess it up four different ways.
You got the preposition though.
Yeah, that was good.
Cognitive science, how my brain worked on that one. But anyway, we really appreciate you, sir. Thank you so much for giving us your time. And as we always say, stay unprofessional.
Thank you, and stay unprofessional. Stay unprofessional.
Stay unprofessional.
Thank you.
Story of my life. Thanks so much, guys. It was great.
That was a blast. Thanks so much.